Hello everyone, welcome back to The Left Page. I am Frank, your always online historian, academic, and writer. I am joined, as always, by my great friend and political scientist, Leon. Hello, Leon.
I'm seeing too many things. It stresses me out.
We definitely are. And to help us see things and talk about seeing things, we have once more the wonderful, the excellent friend, art historian, and podcaster, Nadja. Welcome, Nadja.
Welcome. Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
We're thrilled to have you back, genuinely.
Thank you. I'm really excited for today and for the book we'll be covering. So I'm very, very hyped.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Not to introduce the idea that, frankly, I'm kind of ashamed that we didn't think of earlier, to finally talk about John Berger's Way of Seeing. And I think this coming in at a very good time as well, since we have been talking conceptually about how to approach certain things. So this is honestly a wonderful addition to the current subjects that has been spanning multiple episodes. So yeah, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And I'm excited that you were happy about this choice. It's one of my favorite books in general when it comes to art history and the art understanding of arts, and it's one that I come back very often to, so I'm really excited to be able to talk about it with you guys.
Definitely.
It's sad that he passed away a little while ago, I believe, but luckily we can still get to talk about his ideas.
I'm sorry. I'm just a bit confused with the music, but it was very fun. It was lovely.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I do love a good music. Mm. But yes, I really love this book and the show it was based on. I think you both have seen it too.
Yeah.
And perfect. I love this 1970s look on John as well. Very fashionable, very flashy, and. But yes, this is a book that I read for the first time, I think, 10 years ago, and I keep going back to it. And like you said, it's very relevant nowadays with the way there's so many images around us, and we need to be able to understand them because they are all telling us something. And yes.
Definitely. I think this book is so great because it introduces so many different ideas at a totally perceptible level, as in you don't need to have any kind of thorough education at it. You just need to be somewhat intellectually curious, which sadly is, I do think, I don't know if it's not at all-time low. I don't really care about making such broad statements, but at the same time, I do think in general problem that we are all dealing with as a broader culture, no matter if you look at media, if you look at paintings, if you look at art, if you look at whatever, seems to be a very thorough segment of the population. Let me be polite here. That is thoroughly disinterested at understanding anything or thinking about anything. The very popular statement is "Wow, movies are political. Why would you politicize a movie?" I'm what? and I'm so far on the other side. I'm that sentence doesn't make any sense to me. So that's I do think that this book is then so great because, despite being half a century old, it is literally directly, I'm going to say combative, but it sounds a bit too aggressive, but it literally countering this very intellectual ennui that we are going through right now.
Totally. No, I was saying you're totally right about the fact that John Berger is someone who talks about art in a way that is very accessible to anyone and everyone. As you said, just the moment that you just have a little bit of curiosity and wanting to understand. I think, like you said, there's a good chunk of the population that's very much, who cares if the curtains are blue? They're just blue, that kind of...
not the curtains are blue.
who cares about that? And it's that lack of wanting to dive deeper in what something could mean. Maybe the curtains are just blue, but there is no problem in just looking at a piece of art, whether it's a painting or a movie, and trying to see what it means. And it doesn't really matter what the artists wanted to say. What matters is what you understand from it. And I think it's also like one of the tenets of this book too, that it's the relationship not only between the piece of art and the artist, but also really highlighting the contribution of the third member of like this trio, that is the audience, and how the participation of the audience is like essential in an understanding of a work of art, because the way we see it, ways of seeing indeed, is really how, what determines the significance of a piece of art. I mean, even when it comes to like huge pieces of art, like that are really well known, like whether we're talking about like the Mona Lisa or a Van Gogh or a Monet or whatever, like the reason why these paintings are so popular is because we understand them as such. Like, yeah. Yes, the artists were very talented, very, very skilled, but it's because the audience, the art historians, the critics and everything understand them as being like this important, that they are important. If we just like collectively decided that like we don't care about it, like wouldn't matter, you know what I mean? So it's definitely. Like
exactly,
it's very interesting to me that even if you were to approach this from a fiercely individualist point of view, don't you want to protect yourself for like propaganda, for like unconscious messaging? Like the artist is always thinking about you, or at least you are somewhere near the mind of the artist, or the person that generates the thing, or whatever you want to call it. The person that creates has you in mind. Should you not keep yourself in mind as well? Like, it's so interesting to me that you think by going, well, there's nothing behind, the curtains are just blue, there's nothing behind the curtains, and so forth and so on. Are you not concerned that you leave yourself vulnerable to anything here? And it's really funny that, like, usually the people then who say such statements, as in there is nothing political about it. Wow, being political about this, that's crazy. And I'm like, well, crazy. I think it's crazy to, like, you know, even if, once again, this is not how I approach it. But since you are so eager to approach it at such an individual level, are you not worried about you, the individual, in this process? And apparently they're not. I don't know. They think that by just saying like, oh, there's nothing behind it, therefore it's not damaging. And I'm like, maybe I got an advantage coming from like multiple groups of people that have been depicted, have been severe victims from propaganda efforts, from art and so forth and so on. Like that's never been, it's always been quite obvious to me. And I don't know, I guess there's a certain amount of privilege as well behind this not seeing that we're doing, to look away from a thing. Is a indication of power, I think, even though it is ironically making you powerless as well in intellectual. Anyway, not to make it more complicated than it needs to be, but I do find that very interesting.
No, for sure. No, I think it's really interesting because, especially the show, right, where there's a real honesty to presenting his arguments and the way he's framing it, like very historically grounded. So it's this specific period, this specific tradition. And putting himself out there in terms of like, this is what I am saying, and I'm saying this using these methods of reproduction. This has clearly been prepared and written and presented in a very particular way to my taste, to my presentation, to my interests and arguments. But that must correlate to your experience as the viewer. So he quite clearly, in a, you know, a rare sense of intellectual honesty, is like, this is what I'm doing. Here it is. Have it. Judge it. Understand it. Agree. Disagree. But here it is. And that's really fantastic. I love that kind of thing. It's not as often, it's not as common as it should be. But it's that aspect of respecting the audience, respecting that viewer, right? There's a reason in my notes, I compared John Berger's approach to Barthes, where he's talking about the death of the author so that the role of the reader can emerge. Like, this is the death of a specific kind of critic so that the general viewer, the general audience can emerge as well, right? We're all seeing those images, but the emphasis sometimes on like their mystique, their value, their worth and importance. Well, what do all those things mean, right? Like, why are we looking at this? And why do we find this interesting, or why don't we, right? Like, I mean, this isn't really a hot take, but like, okay, the Mona Lisa, right? Like, incredibly skilled, it's incredibly interesting. So what? There are a lot more other Leonardo paintings that do a lot more, that do a lot more interesting stuff. And there are so many more, right? Like, let's talk about the corpus then. It's not just about this painting, right?
But I think it's interesting that you talked about the Mona Lisa. I think this is like the one painting that anyone who has absolutely no knowledge of art will instantly think about.
Yeah.
And there is a reason actually why it is that popular, and it has nothing to do actually with the skill or that particular painting. Is because in 1911 it was stolen by an Italian who wanted to give it back to Italy, and it has been missing for 2 years before it got back to the Louvre. So during those 2 years, it was incredibly hyped up. There was like a hunt, we're looking back for the paintings. And it's that sort of like effervescent like media storm again around the painting that made it so popular. Before Definitely. That time, it wasn't like, it was a very good painting. It was a Leonardo da Vinci. He is a master of the Renaissance. But it is media that created the Mona Lisa as we know it today. And like you said, Fran, there's a lot of people who actually, when they go to the Louvre, I haven't had the chance to go. I have to admit, like, maybe I will avoid setting foot in France if I can. But there's a lot of people who go to the Louvre and are extremely disappointed with it because it's a small painting. It's it doesn't live to the hype that is around it. But this hype that was created is entirely man-made, which you know, created by the heist stage drama of like a heist. It's like, I love a good heist. I don't know about you. I
oh,
love
for sure.
So this is why it's so popular today. And now that we're like so removed from it, it's been like more than 100 years that this happened. But the like, what's it called? Like the aura around it stayed.
Oh yeah.
And yeah. With also, like, Picasso was accused of like being the guy who stole the Mona Lisa. Like, there was tons of stuff that happened. And then Marcel Duchamp, I think, like, there was a lot of like parodies riffing off the Mona Lisa, using it as a like stepping stone to like rework the painting, using it as a piece of iconography.
Definitely.
And this is why it's so popular, and this is why it is a painting that stays in our like consciousness. Even though, like you said, it's just, I mean, so many people are like, hey, it's not that good. And it's understandable, but it's really like this media. I was going to say social media, but it wasn't really. But, you know, newspapers and everything that built it up more than Definitely. It was. So I feel like it kind of goes into the relationship between like audience, artist, art, and the new like the medias and
yeah.
publicities and advertisement, as John Berger was kind of talking about in the later part of his book. So,
no, that's yeah. I think that's very interesting. It's because it reminds me like once again of like a bunch of things. First off, that I will admit when I was really young and went to Louvre for the first time, I was indeed like, why are all the people gathering around at one little painting? It like doesn't make sense to me. Now it's really funny because once again, my ways of seeing art has been like, has transitioned so much over like, you know, since I was that young boy, like looking at it like, okay, yeah, sure. I understand the importance of it, but there was literally like, there's always, it's one of the few paintings in that hallway where there's always security guards right next to it. And then there's like this whole crowd, like literally like just like pressed up against each other. Like there, and it's so fun. It's so funny to see because that entire illustrious, beautifully designed hallway is empty. Like it's just like that. It's just that painting. And there's just this little like, I don't know, this little like group of people just all pressed up against each other for that painting. And like, even now, even though I find it, I understand the importance. And what you said was very interesting because it shows the multiple processes that can influence the not only the spectacle of it, but the just it shows the postmodern type of alteration of art, of a singular object of art. That's very interesting to me. And one of the processes is indeed like, oh, the mythology around it that we have created. But also, and one that I find very interesting is when you mentioned like the Italian wanted to give back to Italy, because that's such a prominent thing within like art at the moment right now, where we talk about how the certain art, like, you know, the British Museum is usually the one that's said most. Mm-hmm. And it has now so many different processes tied into that as well. Namely that how, well, the British Museum is arguing, or the National Museum, I believe it's called, but the British National Museum is like arguing, well, actually, you can only view it properly in our facility. You can only see it because, you know, we can't give it back to the other countries. And even though this is already usually fueled by a deep sense of racism and colonialism and so forth and so on, they also do it to Greece, which I find very interesting because Greece is like, you know, according to the white European mind, kind of this pathway into the bad regions of the world. So as they see it and as they're arguing it. But even they are like, no, Greece can't get back these statues that we have of them. They can't get back this list of things that they have. And I find this, once again, this argument for, well, only we can preserve it, and therefore you can only properly witness it, and art can only live here. We are the true harbingers of culture and so forth and so on because we are better than others. Like that, this is, to me, as intense as this sounds, not my opinion, but is how they view themselves. And that's such a deeply concerning process, I think.
No, totally. Oh, God, I have so many thoughts on this.
By all means.
I'm sorry.
Frank already knows it. First of all, the fact that they call themselves like, oh, it will be safe in our hands is so blatantly false with like what happened last summer in the British Museum. I don't know if any both of you are aware of it. But yeah, I'll just like, in case not, people don't know about it, but basically a guy who was working there for like 30 years have been stealing.
Just putting on eBay as well.
Yes, have been stealing from the British Museum for like an amount up to like $7 million and selling them on eBay. And I talked a bit about why he wasn't caught before. And this comes from like the fact that my day job is an archivist. And basically they have like one guy for inventory in the whole of the British Museum, and it's a huge job. So basically, from what I understand, he was stealing tins before they were inventoried. So officially, it did not exist in the system, which is why it went unseen, I think, for so long, until he started stealing stuff that was already on the system, and someone was like, excuse me, I've seen this thing before. But basically this happened and it was like a huge breach of security. So it's like your argument about the fact that you're the one who can preserve the safety of these artifacts and objects and works of art is already like null and void and obviously not working out. Second of all, I think the fact that they have so many works of art from the looting and colonizing they did across the world, it's like in Ways of Seeing, he talks about the fact that we see a lot of these works of art now removed from their context. Yeah. He talks about like paintings that were in a state's house in like some British guy who owned like several millions of acres or whatever, or like on the wall of a church. And it's the fact that they were there, it was the context that they were supposed to be seen. And works of art from Africa, from the Middle East, from China and stuff are removed away from their context. And I think it removes away a lot of the significance behind it. I'm Algerian and I follow on Instagram an account that's like Algerian Art and Museum. And so many of it are like in museums in Cleveland. I'm just like, what is it doing there? What is it doing there? Like who in Cleveland cares about it? Like, bring it back home. And I was going to say something else. Goodness. But basically, the colonialism is just such a high point of like museums and cultural institutions, and they don't want to give them. Oh, Greece.
Yes.
I thought about Greece, about like, you know, they don't want to give them back. And it's a way, I think it's because Greece, or Greek art, it considered as the height of like Western art. It's the birth of the Occident, of the West. But also Greek now are not considered as Western as like, you know, French people or English people. And so they don't want to give them back because they're like, this is the symbol of Western identity and it has to stay here.
Yeah.
In the West. And it's like, no, it doesn't work like that. But it's like those statues used to be colored before, and now they're white because the colors has been scrubbed off with time. But it's that understanding of those statues as being white as the symbol of like Western identity, and it's like it's a symbol built on something that's not true, and you know the West must crumble someday.
Always.
No, definitely. It's so funny as well, because this notion of Greece is like something that I encounter a lot in like the social scientific ways of seeing. To indicate Western ignorance, I usually drudge up Greece as in, there's so much to say about this on account because there's like, you can fill a whole podcast with this. But to go through it very quickly, I'm so sorry, dear listener. What I always use as an example is Greek music, like especially Grecian music. Because when I play it to like a bunch of first years, they're usually like, whoa, this is so Eastern. It's so like, wow, it's so weird. I didn't expect that from a Western nation. They don't say Western. Well, some do, but not all of them say Western nation. But they all mean it, whether they know it or not. And then I was like, well, what if I told you that this was Turkish music? And they're like, oh yeah, no, that's totally fine. And Turkey and Greece are right next to each other. They're this close. They're literally they share islands. And I'm like, how? Like, oh, and then well, there's like layers to that as well. As a lot of people claim, like, oh, actually, that's Ottoman influences, the Ottoman colonization process. Like, there's no basis for that at all. Like, there's so many instruments that are just literally from Greece as well and integrated into Turkish. Anyway, there's a whole thing about that. Very lovely topic. We'll probably do another episode about that one day. But it's very interesting how this, once again, this notion of Westernness is inherent to Greece, and so much so that racist Greek people denounce their own culture in order to like say like, what's it called again? Ilonian, I believe it's Ilonian music, but this is a very simple music that's a lot closer to Italian music. And sorry to make this a music podcast all of a sudden. I'm so sorry, dear listener. But it's so interesting that like the music as a part of culture is so alive and is so elusive in so many ways that you can see all the different segments and ways of seeing in like musical development. And I find it so interesting that racist Greek people are like, no, it's only the Ilonian, I don't know what it's called again. I once knew, I'm so sorry. But there's only this type of music that is Greek, actually, and it's very close to Italian music. And I was like, oh well, go figure. And it's wonder. You should talk about white nationalists, what they think about Italy as well. I don't think that's your best option if you really want to go for it. But anyway, this is not important. I'm sorry.
No, it's if anything, the companion books to this conversation and John Berger's book are Edward Said's Culture and Imperialism and Orientalism. That's the bottom line here, because Greece is such an interesting focus of that, because as you both put it, like, it's the birth of the West and it's the birth of democracy where this all comes from, but only past Greece.
Don't ask current what
Greece,
kind of democracy they had.
Let's keep them away right now, right? Like, they're not really like us. They're not that good. They're not that West, right? Like, and it's like such a weird, like, it's a taking of a history, but a denying of the present. And it's Orientalism. It's Orientalism towards, you know, certain peoples in Europe that they recognize and value, but not really.
Yes, that's because I teach Europeans a lot, and I'm you know, I don't think every European, but you know, like in general, the West focuses more on like a clean Western identity rather than like regional cultural identity, which it has. Whether like white supremacy is like nothing but racism, it's not a culture, and it ignores like the every like specificity and art and culture of like white people, and they're like, okay, but what about white culture? And it's like white culture is not it's not computers and going to McDonald's. Like every people has like a regional history and culture, but that's not what they value. That's like what they value is just being able to steal from the other and like, you know, prop up like white supremacy. So I'm just like, I don't really care for that. Like, you could care about your own culture, but you obviously do not. So,
yeah.
What can I say?
I got very lucky because I feared a version of me that was like just like Dutch and only had like a Dutch heritage for that matter. It's because I benefited a lot from like, once again, being raised by my mom and who's from the south of Spain, and as like the south of Spain especially, is everybody there understands that there's no monotone culture. There's no place in the world that's just one culture. And like, they understand very well, some of them at least, understand very well how multifaceted this process is and always will be, and so forth and so on. And this idea that we all like, last example, I'm so sorry. But online, I saw people arguing who invented like what we call tejos, the like little brick temp. I don't know what to call them in English, but these little like tiles, like, and oh, actually, this is a Turkish invention. Like, oh, actually, this is Iranian invention. Like, first off, we were part of the same empire twice in history, so I don't know why are we arguing about this? I do not understand this. And anyway, that's long story short, but. It's so interesting to me. Like, we can talk about the genesis of things. We can talk about like the origins of things, and like, but understand this is always like an academic debate. It's not necessarily, and this is then always emotion by what we uncover on archaeological fronts and so forth and so on. It's weird to me the wrong type of value we attach to these things. The value that I attach to it is that it's beautiful because we share it. And they're not like, oh, this is what makes my culture my culture. And it's okay to have these identifiers as in, oh, this is a part of my culture and so forth and so on. And we contributed to it rather than like, oh, we made it and it's just ours, actually. And everybody's just loaning it from us. Like, that's so, I never understood that desire very well. I'll stop there because otherwise that will be the rest of the episode. I'm sorry.
And I think also it's a misunderstanding of the way art and culture works, because it is something that is being shared. And I read a book a couple of months ago that's like objects, like global arts of objects. I don't remember quite the title. I'll give you the title eventually. But basically it was the way globally art and culture was shared, and like maybe they were talking about a 17th century Dutch chair that was influenced by Japanese art. And it's just the way our culture has always been global and interconnected. And I think it's silly to pretend that we're not connected in any kind of way, whether by art, culture, and especially in like 2024 now, where, you know, we're more connected than ever, and there's more images than ever, and everything influences us, and we influence the world as well. So it's just, we're all part of the same web of connection and influences. And I think it's silly to pretend that we're an island and disassociated from all of this.
Yeah, it is a denial of the history of these objects, of these arts, and these artists as well. Like, that, how did they do that? How did these things come about? How do they blend all these things together, right? Like, it's one of the things that John Berger points out, and I particularly find interesting when I'm thinking about literature, which is, how do these, you know, we're talking about sometimes about like these masters or these geniuses or whatever, and like, yeah, sure, but they are that and they act and present things in a certain way because of or in response to their tradition. Their tradition, which involves so many more paintings, and if we're thinking literature, so many more books, which exist, some survived, plenty more didn't, and maybe aren't as well remembered or as thought of, but still make a part of that tradition. And to ignore that, or to like, oh, that's not as important, it's too, well, to one, to minimize what the geniuses, the masters did in their connection to that tradition, and to misunderstand art history, the history of literature, history in general, because it is like to isolate and no, these are valuable, these are important, these are significant. Well, why? In what way are they? No, they are because they are. It's you know, this deifying of like, no, but these are just important. And sure, maybe they are. Like, I'm not here to my quibbles, or rather my strong issues and resentments about the canon aren't that like, oh, these books aren't important or aren't good. No, but why? In what ways are they? And like, we must ask those questions, right? Why are these books here? And it's not necessarily it's like, oh, every book should be. No, like, there's plenty of bad ones, but as the same way as like a lot of the paintings that John Berger talks about, like, they're very similar, they're generic, and that's fine. But that's exactly the point. Like, they're not an important because of it. They're not less worthy of study, of research, of interest, really, because they are more generic or more part of that tradition. Like, quite the opposite. That makes them just as important, just as necessary to understand things in context, for Christ's sakes.
No, you're so right. And like, especially oil paintings in the 19th century and stuff. Like, John Berger talks a lot about it, about how it was a status symbol more than anything. And those paintings were both like, oh, the owner of the painting is able to commission those paintings. That's a lot of money at that point.
Yeah. And
so the fact that you're able to commission this painting is already like a point in your favor status-wise in my socially and in your society. But also generally those paintings that Berger talks about is you know, the person is like swathed in like so much fabric, and there's everything behind them, and all of these objects are symbols of status and like hyping up and the person who is painting, and they're dressed in their most expensive clothes and finery. And while now we don't have the same value ascribed to clothing, like back then it was expensive, like you, like silk, and it was super expensive. So having like someone dressed really expensively really signaled something to anyone who would see that painting. And those symbols of status that we see in that painting, like maybe won't be as intuitive to us because it's part of another society, so we won't necessarily understand what it means, but we can just still infer from them. But this would have said something to people in their time. So it's just those paintings were not necessarily made as huge works of art, and even the understanding of art that we have now as like an expression of self is a fairly recent one. It's only with like, I think, the late 18th century. I will say only in the Western tradition, because this is what Berger is really focusing about. He's like, that's what I know. That's what I'm focusing on. But it's really with the Romantics in the late 18th century where it started to be like, oh yeah, art as an expression of self. But before that it wasn't the case. It was just you could commission a guy to like put a painting on you. And, you know, like not all of these paintings, like you said, are really valuable in a way or another. There were just paintings in a style in the 19th century. But like, why this one more than the other? Like, you write this. There's question to be asked, and there's nothing wrong to try to analyze why a work of art is more valuable artistically or historically than another. Or like even monetarily wise, why is this painting worth $18 million and this one is worth $5?
Doesn't need to store value.
Exactly. So there's but yeah.
No, but I think that's exactly it. I think what's really great is that you both like if we have identified like two different processes, but they're not really different processes. They are rather like a dual pronged approach. I think Frank, what you said is the more colonial project, as in we will decide what there is the well, we earlier talked about like, oh, the curtains are just blue, and then there is the Western academic notion of, well, the curtains are blue only because of this, and we discount every other way because once again we are the true harbingers of culture. And within like what you have been saying is indeed what used to be the justification for colonialism, that the rest of the world needs our enlightened economic and thinking models. And it's so funny to me that this the process of enlightenment in Europe is like the dumbest thing, I think, structurally speaking. Like, it's such a non-enlightening way to think about things, ironically. And to champion like, oh, this is how we should look at things is a deeply ongoing, still ongoing, very much still ongoing, a colonial notion. And it's trying to expunge from all from art all the readings that are like not Western, quote unquote, Western European notions or American nowadays as well. I think that fits in Western. Never mind, not important. But this Western group of people, like expunging all non-Western notions from it, and also like how academia has functioned for the longest time. Like, academia is still running on the wheels, so to speak, of a very dark past, or in the, once again, not past because it's still going. And it is very bad at acknowledging its own dark history in that matter. Or once again, not history, but also still very much present. It's an ongoing process, even though it's trying to reconcile it a little bit, but definitely not enough in my opinion. Anyway, then Nacha as well like indicated like this capitalist, current capitalist function of art. And I, once again, these are not two different processes, the colonial and the capitalist, because they go hand in hand. They have lunch together. they talk to each other all the fucking time. And so this notion that what I find very interesting is how I absolutely despise cryptocurrency and NFTs, but there was a very odd moment in which cryptocurrency and NFTs were functioning in a way that liberated modern contemporary art, as in modern contemporary art in a very practical way was on a siege by criminals for trying to store value in paintings. They assaulted like appraisers and so forth and so on. Like, oh, we need this painting to be like millions of dollars because once again, we need to whitewash this amount of money. And it's really funny that those people, a lot of them pivoted towards cryptocurrency because once again, cryptocurrency, the only good thing about it is that then that became the object to just to function like assets on like stock markets and so forth and so on. I won't bore anybody with that, but that is like it's such a funny way that how art has been under siege and at the same time, ironically, created thanks to capitalist processes. Anyway, I hope modern art does better now or not. I don't know how that's going, actually, but I did find that a very interesting moment and shows in a very simple way the direct capitalist relation to art and how capitalist, in my opinion, is inherently hostile to art and culture.
There's just a brief point. Like there's one thing that Jim Berger says in the documentary that, and I didn't flag it the first time I watched it, but I wrote it down this time because it's like, oh, you know what? You're right. That the oil painting is the most valuable object of all. And I like individually, I was like, yeah, you're probably right. Like oil paintings themselves, like a single oil painting is probably one of the most valuable, expensive objects you can have still today. And I was like, fucking hell. And again, it's so abstract. Like it really doesn't like, oh, why is this painting that is going to hang in a reserve room worth £2.5 million in the 70s, or I don't know, $18 million today or whatever. Like, what is the value here? What is the significance? Like, prove it to me, not to either of you, obviously, but like, prove it to me. It's like, okay, why is this worth all this? Like, okay, so, oh, this person painted. Okay, why is this valued this or that? Like, does that mean that this painting is more important? Well, whenever I try to think about, you know, this question of value, like monetary value to art and in terms of art history as well, it's like, yeah, the whole logic falls apart because it's not correlated in anything material, if, to put it in the most clear terms.
Yeah, not
no,
to
it's
us.
Not. And no, I would want to say no, it's not, because let's say you have a painting, and for you it's just a painting. You try to value it. The guy is like, yeah, it's $100 or whatever. But if you manage to prove that it's made by this particular artist, and suddenly it's the value skyrockets. But it's the same painting. It like nothing really has changed in terms of the work of art, but it's the context, the artist, and the value of that artist now. And it's just so, there's nothing set in stone. Like, it's just a vibe based.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't have answers to that, because it's just very complicated and obscure. Like, people who do that don't want you to know, like, why they put this value or not. And it's just,
yeah.
Goodness.
But that's exactly, like, for me, how the capitalist project functions. It is, mm-hmm. It doesn't know how to approach. Ideally, they should appraisers, and I'm not saying that this goes for all appraisers, because a lot of appraisers do actually know a lot about the art and are having genuine interest in art. However, when we appraise a thing, we are trying to put a price tag on it. That appraising sounds very nice, but actually, at the end of the day, it is, we need to put a price tag on it. And how do you put a price tag on things? Well, sadly, that has already been dictated by both colonial and capitalist models, saying that, well, let's look at how stocks work, for instance. And like you said, that's very much vibe-based, and it's so concerning, because it's like, oh, well, this day I feel like selling those stocks. Oh, this day I don't feel like selling those stocks. And sadly, that is kind of like how this project of scarcity as well is then placed upon the painting, including the colonial project that assigns values, as in a Rembrandt is worth more than an indigenous artist, for example. Or once again, if it's just an indigenous artist from a culture that is no longer existing because it has been destroyed by colonialism, for instance, then it goes up because it's a scarcity product. So you see how art, sorry to reiterate myself here, I'm so sorry, but we see how capitalism is directly assaulting art, as in it places, it subjects us to the capitalist notion of scarcity, which is then how, to answer your question, Frank, is sadly, how I think the whole assignment, of art works, namely, like, sadly, everything else. So that's filtered through the colonial cultural lens and adjusted for the capitalist current contemporary thing.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. I mean, there's this story I've heard several years ago in a contemporary history class in college, and we were talking about art and art history, and talking about Gustave Courbet.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently that there was a painting which was like, oh, is this supposed to reference another painting of his? Oh, but is it from him? Is it like supposed to be the same model or whatever? And apparently one appraiser is like, oh no, it is, and that skyrocketed the value. And while afterwards other critics, other appraisers, like, no, actually it's not. It's from a different person, or it's obviously not from the same model, the same painting for X, Y, and Z, but that doesn't matter, because the initial effect was already successful in abstractly raising the value of the painting, because we wanted it to be valuable, we wanted it to be that, and so there's the actual, it's that kind of thing. It's like, oh, it's the evidence, it's, you know, the actual investigation of it. Not really, because there are a lot of other values in play. There's ideology in play the whole time. So it's not... We started this... I'm not sure if it was before or after we already started recording, but like, there's no neutral position. There's no neutral stance.
There is none. There is none. And like it's the, for example, the canon of art is like used as an objective way of understanding art and saying these are the paintings you need to understand. You need to study and these are the best paintings in the world or the most important ones. And it's like these are chosen really in a white Western ideology. And it's like, and those paintings are important, but it's, I think it's important to emphasize that these are in the Western tradition. And if you are going to do like an extensive world canon, there is so many like places like that you could like take the art of, and like Indian art, Chinese art, Japanese art, Islamic art, indigenous art. There's so many works of art that are just as important and should be valued. And I think it's wrong to like say, oh, the canon of art as if it's something that's settled in stone and not something that people have decided on, that, oh, these are the important works that we should study to be able to understand art history correctly. And while I agree that those works of art are important to understand art history correctly, it's the way that people project it as like this is a settled in stone, nothing else is important. Yeah. And there's like, you know, maybe a token piece of like a Japanese art and maybe a token piece of African art, but it feels very tokenized and not like actually understood and appreciated. And it's like, this is really the perspective from which we understand and see art. And this is also like everything that John Berger was saying about like the importance of seeing and the importance of the gaze. As I think, even though as much as it is often overplayed, but it's something that really defines the way we look at art, and by understanding not only the context in which the art has been created, but in understanding the context in which it's been given to us and it, the context in which it's being displayed and perceived. And I think like we are the perspective, and our perspective is never neutral. Like I'm a woman of color, I have a specific perspective that someone else might not have, and we have our own biases and understanding, and we should always work to unravel these biases. Like none of us is perfect, but these personal understanding will always affect the way we see and understand and analyze art. And I think it's silly to pretend that there's a objective way to be able to criticize and understand works of art, whether it's paintings or books or movies, yeah, or anything. And there's always more than to it than just there's just never a neutral perspective. That's just the lie we've been fed. It doesn't exist. Even even in science, objectivity doesn't really exist. Like even though there's the results, like the facts are very, like you can't change the fact that this particular result is 5, for example. I don't know, I'm not a scientist. But what I mean is like you have a certain result, but like the way you understand that result will always be biased. There's a way why people also criticize science, because it has been a way of justifying racism and colonialism. So it's yeah, never neutral.
Yeah, no, I think that's very interesting. I just wrote something about this objectivity thing as well. So I'm sorry, dear listener, for going over this again. But I do think it's very interesting, because there is this, and I think just such a big struggle, let me say it differently. I think such a big struggle nowadays is that, to once again arc back to what I said in the beginning as well, people who are like, oh, no, there's nothing behind this, the curtain is just blue, and so forth and so on. The struggle is with their philosophical notions of objectivity. And I think that this notion of utterly simplistic, and I'm so sorry to sound condescending here, but it is what it is. This utterly simplistic notion of objectivity has been such a small scale disaster, I think, that is still echoing through like so many different processes. Namely, that they are like, okay, well, anything that I can see is like that is real and anything I can touch that is real. It's like, huh, funny you say that. There's a whole phenomenological philosophy tree there for you to explore if, once again, you were more intellectually curious. But that, even that put aside, yes, we can talk about how within the mathematical science, about what you say, like 5 equals something, we can talk about how the mathematical processes of identity relations, so forth, and set theory can help us to come to that conclusion. However, there's also the different objective, in my opinion, as close as we can get to objectivity, process that I experience when I work with children who were put outside of homes due to their that process being very difficult for them and being in this institution. And that's run by my uncle. And anyway, I talked about that another time. I don't have time to reiterate it. I'm so sorry. But during that process, we were working on somebody who we suspected was on the autism spectrum. And they said something that I always keep reiterating as an example, namely that 3 + 3 = 8. Because when you put two threes together, it forms an 8. And I'm like, oh, that's so... Like, but once again, that is a very interesting way of seeing. And it is, within the subjective rules that are applied, objectively correct. And I think this little boundary between both, once again, the mathematical process that is also correct within the set of rules for that child, that is also correct. And so anyway, long story short, I think this has been such a terrible, unprofound non-curiosity in how intellectual processes can work. And this has resulted in like this once again, this intellectual ennui that we see online so often. And sadly, for me, also sometimes in person. That's
Totally. No, you're so right. And it's just like always nostalgia and going back to the past. And I don't know, I always feel a kind of way about it because I'm an art historian. Like, Frank, you're also a historian. Like, you know, we love to look back at the past. It's fascinating to me. I'm also an archivist. I love old things. And I love when works of art have layers of references to, like, works of art past and, like, visual references to other old movies and new movies. For me, it feels like sometimes as if the artist like has done their homework in a way of like, absorbing what has become, what was there before, and creating something new with layers and something that has substance. But at the same time, I feel that it is so overdone with the way everything is just something that has been done before. And I'm just like, can we have something new? I beg of you. Like, and I know that some people are doing it, especially like smaller artists. And I fully believe in the look at your peers for the art that you want to see. Because corporations are not going to give it to you. But like when I see the mainstream culture and that, it's just all nostalgia driven. And it's just all a bit publicity. It's like the last chapter of John Bergeron, publicity, and the way it just always refers to the past to like look to the future. But it's just, I feel like now we're just stuck in a loop of that, of always looking to the past to advertise us something.
Yeah.
And it's just that was in 1972 already common enough for John Berger to like make a note of it. But now in 2024, I'm just like, this is even worse.
there's an interesting connection there, because that both the canon and the publicity they dehistoricize these works, these pieces, like they're isolated, right? Like they either reference something that's like, oh, this represents something important, thus you want to buy this, or do you want to go and do that, or do you want to travel to there, or do you want to go to the place to see that? Or there's like, oh no, this is important because it is, and this is the important bit, and never mind the other stuff. It all lacks this historical aspect to it, which all these pieces do, and I'm always baffled. That's like, oh no, like these pieces are important, or these books are important, whatnot, or like this current canon is important. And like, sure, but when you look at the history of it, like how do these things come about? How do these things relate? what you get out of it is something so much greater, so much more interesting than if you just, oh no, but this piece is important. Okay, give me some more. Let's talk about it then. Like, let's genuinely go deep into it. And what publicity does is that cutting off, like it outlines it, what's significant, cuts out all the rest, and like, oh, this is useful to sell this because you want this, or we want you to have that. And it's like the same process of separating it, isolating it from all that it supposedly gives it meaning, gives it sense. It is, at the end of the day, it all boils down to, oh, you know this is valuable, thus, and so on. Then the same goes for the canon, same goes for publicity. It's all about value. It's all about capitalism. Hey.
Exactly. It's about the value, the prestige that like a painting gives you. And like you were saying, like, you know, those publicity when they reference a specific work of art or a painting from like 19th century oil painting tradition with like works of art that are part of the canon. And the fact that they are part of the canon gives it a sense of prestige, of importance. And so when they use that word in a publicity, they're like, see, you too can be important and have prestige and be fantastic. If you just buy this for the steep price of one, I don't know how much, but that's what it does. And even like oil paintings, that's what it did do before there was publicity and capitalism in the way it existed after like the 1920s when we really entered the modern era. And paintings were what used to give people prestige. Like, you used to enter someone's home and they had like a portrait made of themselves by Sargent. And it's like, yeah, I posed for him. Yes, it's he's very chill. He painted me in this in this dress or whatever. But that the fact that you owned this painting was a proof of prestige. And this is I love art, but it's, you have to also understand the relationship like between capitalism and art, and also colonialism and the way that the way that paintings are just also used to validate the colonizing project by depicting people, like racialized people, in a way that's subservient of validating the feelings that white people had. So you can be like, yeah, this is why we're going there. Like, look at this painting. Look at this, what it says. Have you seen those barbarians? We need to civilize them. And so art used to be also a justifying point for imperialism.
Yeah, it reminded me something we were talking before, that, you know, like, oh, art was, you know, for patrons or for a specific reason or whatnot, and wasn't just like, oh, art for art or disinterested and whatnot or this expression. No, for a lot of reasons, and still today, and not for bad reasons, art is very interested. It is interested in, I don't know, being something, in portraying that person or in expressing this. Like, oh, but you're just doing that because of this reason. No, like, art pretty much always has been interested. Uninterested art is a rare phenomena, if ever.
That's the thing, like...
Sorry.
But that's the thing. There's a lot of art that's uninterested in saying anything apart from being, like, a pretty picture. And even though there's nothing inherently wrong with that, like, if you, as a hobby, you just like to draw a pretty picture, that's fine. But it's a lot of like what those return sort of fascist accounts, and it's like those are just pretty pictures that don't mean anything. And a lot of it was just sludge that just people were producing. Yeah. And not everything is important. And I think it can be important to you, but like culturally, historically, and everything, not everything needs to be kept and valued. Yeah. And some of it can just be like a pretty painting. It's fine. You can just like it. It's okay. But we still have nowadays a lot of uninterested art being made, and it for me, it's a lot of filler in a lot of ways. Yeah. I mean, with TV, there's so many things that are being made. I'm just like, this is not very good. This feels empty. This doesn't feel like something that matters. So, and I think like AI is the same. I'm just, well, no one has made any effort to make this. So why should I care about this?
Yeah.
And it doesn't say anything either. And like you said about propaganda, so much of it is like art is always saying something. If it's not like an empty just filler picture just to make an image, but it's always saying something and you have to be able to understand what it is saying. Is it trying to lure you in a specific direction or the other? And especially with all of the visual messages and images that we're surrounded with completely, if you don't understand what it's saying, you're leaving yourself very vulnerable to being influenced. And it's like, just understand, and then you can make a choice, an informed choice in whatever way you need.
Yeah, no, definitely. I find it very interesting because it's usually like the conversation that I have with people who are not very interested in, and once again, are very uncurious about all these different processes, is that, I'll acknowledge that I do admittedly know a lot more about oil paintings, but then I also know a lot about architecture and so forth and so on, all these other kind of processes. But I don't know about a lot. That's maybe a bit too self-aggrandizing. I'm sorry. a decent bit, more than average. Let's just keep it at that. About those two things. But then I also know a lot about modern art, which is then usually thrown under the bus as a form of appraisal for like the oil painting, the classical, quote-unquote classical art, and so forth and so on. And as much as I love those paintings, I find it very interesting that they're like, okay, well, yeah, it's just a line on like, over on the canvas, I'm like, so? Like, why would that exclude it from meaning? I don't understand how, once again, I think this is a very clear moment in which this enlightened colonial cultural project has succeeded. As in, people will just say, like, oh, this modern art is nothing. It's just, I could have made that, and so forth and so on. And I'm like, it's very clear to me that you have never like seen the series of paintings by Who's Afraid of Red, Yellow, and Blue by Bernard Newman, who has this very, well, anyway, that's homework for if you are curious about that, dear listener. I don't have time to talk about it, but it's one of those kind of paintings, this not Pollock type paintings, but this line work with bright colors. And try and see if you can maybe find like some meaning behind it, because there's a lot, and it's a very well-known series of paintings and so forth and so on, and it ties into some very deep notions. And even if you think that the painter has painted it just because, the fact that it is painted just because maybe says something about society and so forth and so on, there's always something there for you. And I don't know, I think that do not reiterate what I've been saying throughout the thing, but
it's... No, but you're totally right. And I think people don't quite understand the difference between I don't personally like it visually, this is not my sort of thing, versus this has no meaning or inherent like artistic value to it. And I think the fact that also these kind of paintings continue to elicit such violent reactions from people who are like, okay, but I could do that. It's like, why do you feel that way? Like, why is this art just make you feel so, like, maybe analyze that. Like, maybe think just a little bit.
Just a little.
But I feel like the fact that these works of art who have been done, like, in the 40s, you know, that's a long time ago. And yet people are still feeling so many emotions about like these paintings that are just a square of blue or a square of, like, just someone who, like, well, I could have done that. Okay, why didn't you then? Yeah. Do something. You think you could have that? Become an artist. I just beg of you, like, if you think you could have done this, do it. Like, just do it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's just like, you don't have to like it personally. I admit it's not my favorite kind of art, visually, aesthetically. I love illustration from like the 1920s. I love I know what I love visually, but it doesn't mean that you can't look at something and understand intellectually what's going on behind it. And yeah. I think, like you said, it's the lack of curiosity and self-reflection. Like, you're visibly feeling kind of a way about it. Like, why? Just think about it, please.
The fact that Duchamp's fountain still elicits a kind of revulsion is a testament to it still being current, to still being effective as a work of art. That's like, yeah, exactly. You get it. You don't get it, but that's exactly the point.
That's exactly. It's still relevant. Like, people are still like feeling a kind of way about it. I'm just like, okay, I beg you, look inwards at yourself. Think a little. And it's a lot of like, oh, why artists aren't doing that anymore? And it's like, okay, but also some artists are doing that currently. There's a lot, there's a Canadian indigenous artist who does very detailed oil paintings, but by putting indigenous people at the center of it, and sort of like a subversion of the colonial project in Canada in the 19th century. And like, he's doing it. Like, some people are doing it, but why aren't you interested? I mean,
yes, emphatically yes.
Yeah, I think that such a problem as well is, and I'm sorry, once again, this is exactly all what we've been talking about, but another phenomenon of what we've been talking about is how, once again, the capitalist hostility towards art has now generated a class of artists that are not working class, that are all like, you know, sorry to make it like very Marxist here again, but it's just, you know, but it doesn't have to be, you don't even have to approach it from a Marxist perspective. It is just the fact that we are drawing art from a very select group of people who have broadly similar, not identical, but broadly similar childhoods, socioeconomic relations, ways of seeing. I'm so sorry. But, you know, ways of seeing art. And yeah, I think that has been also like such a tremendous loss for art in a very contemporary sense, that we, once again, due to the hostile relationship towards art, you cannot, and like the only correct answer to why didn't you paint it when someone says like, well, I could have painted that, is, well, it's too expensive. Like, that's the only acceptable answer to that question. Like, why didn't you then? And like, well, and then if you realize, well, it's too expensive, then maybe you should be intellectually curious about why is it too expensive? How come? Why is it so safeguarded? Why, if art wasn't as important and powerful as it is, then, you know, the capitalism wouldn't safeguard it as much as it is doing right now. It is like, once again, the education to understand it is expensive, or at least it's not easily obtainable. Let me just say that. And, you know, like, even though I am very happy that nowadays with our connectiveness that we indicated earlier, this is becoming more of a thing, and this is generating a lot of discussion and a new way of understanding, which I think is cool. But at the same time, there's also more the hierarchical process that's still in place by these institutions that safeguard art, once again, British National Museum, so forth and so on, and as an extension of colonial project, which we already have said. So I'll skip over that. But, you know, I'm very distressed, and I see it in so many ways, because a lot of people are like, oh, especially about TV series and movies, like, oh, that point in that movie wasn't as spectacular as that. It was a bit of lame, and you can see the, like, how do I say this politely? You can see the non-committal liberal project of a certain kind of class within society within a lot of movies and TV shows nowadays. And maybe that's, once again, because the people doing that can do that because of nepotism and social capital. And anyway, I'll stop there. Otherwise,
no. But you're totally right. That reminded me even, and I'll do this little plug here of an episode I did quite some time ago talking about poetry, even, which is not my field of expertise, even in literature. On the book Stanzas for Four Hands, an Ophonym by Dominic Knowles and Matilda Cullen, where we talked about, along a variety of things, like how the Poetry Foundation and certain institutions for, you know, for art, for poetry, have their hands soaked in blood, which, you know, still a present issue, but something that exists in, like, this world of official art, in this institutional environment of art, that which sanctions and denies art, right? Like, there's a reason why certain artists, certain forms of art, like, oh, but no one is doing that, or oh, who is doing that? It's like a lot of people, but they're just not being seen enough, or they're not being given the space or the opportunity or the moment or the finance to do it. Like, they're trying what they can, but art is one of the most difficult, expensive, and unsustainable forms of living. Even today, with certain renewals in forms of patronage and whatnot, like, it's still insufficient. So to even ask that question, like, oh, but who is doing that? Like, oh, or rather, let me rephrase that. To even pose, like, oh, but no one is doing that kind of art or whatever. It's like, no, one, there are people doing that. And two, why aren't people doing that kind of thing? Why is that model not sustainable right now? That's the question that needs to be asked. Like, and that's the question which involves looking at the present, criticizing the present, looking at the history involved, and so on. And, you know, historicize, critique, question, like, judge. Like, as John Berger asks, like, I am presenting this via my arguments, via what I'm doing, and that must be judged by your experience as well. Like, don't take this as gospel. Question it. Think about it. That's what he's proposing. And that's what we humbly have been trying to do as well.
No, exactly. And also, like you said, like not being able to do that kind of art, like we're talking about the extensive detail, like gigantic oil painting. But a lot of these artists used to, like in the Renaissance and then like maybe until the 18th century, they used to be patroned by like very rich people. And they had a lot of time to do it. That's all they had to do. Like a lot of paintings, when you see the date of when the art was made, it's not like 1 year. It was made over like a couple of years for one painting. And like nowadays, if you do an art like in more than 2 months, people are like freaking out. It's like, give people some time to create the art that they want to create. And, like, their food was taken care of, their lodging was taken care of. Like, you didn't have all that, surviving to think about.
Yeah.
And so, like, once these were taken care of, you could dedicate yourself to creating a very detailed, extensive piece of art. And I think, like, it's not a sustainable to ask to, like, pretend that nowadays it's doable in that sort of scale. And even those artists, they used to like take commissions to be able to create the art that they wanted to create. And so it's like, yeah, I'm going to paint one dude sitting in his office surrounded by objects to make sure people understand he's rich, and then I'll create like what I want to create. And it's logical.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's really funny because the process of prestige, the process of gaining social capital already starts with hiring, indeed, the artist as like a prominent family. Like the fact that you have like a wing in your villa or chateau or whatever dedicated to that space so that a whole human being can take a residence in there and you don't even know they exist. The fact that you are hiring somebody is already generating value for your name, for it's already you're generating a sense of social capital. And I find it very not surprising to me that once again, this is not exclusively, far from exclusively, because this goes back into antiquity as well in certain forms and ways, but it doesn't surprise me that like so many of these, once again, very famous oil paintings are Dutch, because the Dutch people already did this type of storing value in objects, both social capital and actual monetary value, in like the tulips, for instance. There was this process of like, yeah, this is just one flower and it's worth so much money. Don't worry about it. Don't ask any questions as to why. And it's so scarce. I don't have like 100 in my backyard at the moment. Don't worry about it. And it's just like this. It's so funny because at least the painting is a cultural project. As it's man created, created from nature, for us, as is everything. But the tulip is just it's a flower. It's an organic object, And I find it so funny that the Dutch were like, yeah, let's store value in that. And it's also no coincidence here that the first stock market ever was a Dutch creation. Like, we unleashed so much evil upon the world. I don't have time for all of this, but there's so much storing of value that, to me, like, our personal history or our cultural history, it comes from, like, right here, right around the corner. So, I don't know. I find that so intricate in how this social capital way works, and like how prestige can be derived from, once again, the Enlightenment type of thinking, this very somber way that the Dutch people dress themselves, like it was all black. But my properties, now there's some prestige to be derived from that. And I find that like intriguing and horrifying at the same time. I'll just keep it at that, but yeah.
Well, we've been at this for a little over an hour. I think we can carry on to our final points if we have them. There's been a lot.
I have one experiment still for you guys if you want, but it's
Of course, by all means.
Hold on, and try to look at it for just about a second.
Okay,
and then look away. Okay, did you guys see the cigarette or the cigar?
It took me a while to see it. I think it's only
really,
after
not
you
in
said
a second.
It.
Okay, so there you go. So that I will attach the image to the episode description so you can look along, dear listener. But that's like one very interesting way of like how we see, and how if you do not know that the cigar is there, you might have seen the cigar without seeing the cigar. Which is, once again, what I'm trying to say since the beginning of this episode, like how our ways of seeing can implant images into our conscious and so forth without us actually seeing that. And this is very innocent. It's a bit silly because this is just a cigar. But imagine, once again, something more insidious and so forth and so on. And this is, once again, my final point as to how important it is that we take our time to, A, look at the thing and then think about the thing even much more than that. This image was shown by a Dutch neuroscientist called Surya Geyt, and he has been like showing people this image is, for example, but other images. He referenced the, I don't know if you guys remember the Facebook dress about like, is it blue or black or gold or white?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
that old classic. That's also amazing. And the most magnificent, I don't know if it has English subtitles, but you can still just watch it in Dutch, even though it is in Dutch. there is like the person that asks directions to another person. Then it is orchestrated that two people holding like a big canvas walk in between the two people that having a conversation. So their sight is interrupted. But behind the canvas was another woman. That then starts talking to the person that the other woman that is now walking away was interacting in conversation with. They're wearing the same type of clothes, a coat, a hat, and like jeans. But they are a different color coat, different color hat. And the people just start talking, just keep talking, like as if they don't register that this is a different person. So this is like deeply concerning way in which the ways we see can be deeply vulnerable. And like, it's too late to make a broad political statement here, but this I would also very humbly like to ask you to keep in mind how sanctified the eyewitnesses, for instance, in certain legal systems, and how deeply fragile of a thing this is. I don't have a suggestion to replace it with anything. I'm not saying the eyewitness is far from unimportant. I would just like you to be acquainted with the neurological reality that what we see in high definition is about the size of our palm. Like if you stretch out your hands, and the broadness of your your palm is how broad we see high definition. The rest is very much blurred and so forth and so on. So anyway, that's my last final to make everybody feel very insecure about everything they see. just you know, take some time and ask yourself, you know, some questions. Maybe that would be great. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, very smart. Very smart. Thank you again for having me. It was extremely a pleasure of being here and of talking with you too. And I'm very glad we could get as in depth as we did about so many subjects, and using this book as a sort of way to jump on various topics. And thank you again for inviting me.
Always.
No, thank you so much for joining us again, Aja. And we'll definitely have to have you on again, because it always ends up being an incredible episode and a great conversation all the same.
Thank you.
And as you're at it, listener, go follow and listen to Naja's podcast as well, Imaginarium.
Thank you. I've just finished the latest season, so I now have 3 seasons. I talk about various subjects of art history and visual history and try to use them as a jumping point to analyze cultures, society, and I usually end up being like, and this is why capitalism and imperialism should be dismantled. Even though I started like pretty pictures of a garden station, I always end up at this point on stage like front and tell you I can, yes. And I've just finished the season, and the last episode was about fates and frauds and art heights, which was very exciting to me. And I hope people like it if they listen to it. And I was very glad to be here and to join you. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Naja. Go check out Naja's 3rd season and the rest of her podcast, which I definitely attest is incredible. And I'm always learning more from it, and definitely really appreciate it. And we appreciate you coming on again. And thank you so much again, Naja. Thank you as always, Leon. Thank you so much, everyone. I mean, of course,
you're welcome.
Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you for listening.